when last we spoke, I was telling you about how easy it is to solve this problem when the matrix is orthogonal. In fact, as you can see, you don't even need to compute a matrix inverse. It's really just inner products. And so if you want to find the best approximation of this vector x using at most m columns of this matrix, you just pick the set of these guys that have the largest inner products with x in absolute value. That's it. May not be unique, but other than that, it's straightforward. So you compute inner products, you sort them, and then you start pulling them off until you've got m of them. All right, so why is this case so easy? And the answer is geometry. So basically, the inner products between the atoms are small in the orthogonal case. And you couldn't imagine they could be any smaller, in fact, because they're all zero. Okay? So it turns out that's good news. So it's easy to tell orthogonal vectors apart. And it's hard to tell parallel vectors apart. They look the same. So you can imagine that if your dictionary had two identical atoms in it, you could never decide which one actually belonged in the approximation of the vector. Okay. You're going to have to throw one of them out or the other. But in fact, it's even worse if they're only separated by a small angle. So this is sort of the intuition that I wanted to capture here. And so two examples. So in two dimensions, you can think about a dictionary that's got three vectors in it. One, two, three. They're all normalized, which is why I've drawn the circle here. And so the angles between these vectors are pretty big. And so it's pretty easy to tell them apart. On the other hand, you can imagine another dictionary where the vectors look like this. And in this case, it's very difficult to decide whether you'd rather have this guy or this guy.
Yeah. Well, is this problem only easy in the orthogonal case because we're using the two norm to measure the error, or would it still be easier if we're using another different norm? Say L1 or something like that.
That's actually another one of the reasons people use the L2 norm is that it really is much nicer analytically. It simplifies a lot of these ideas. I mean, the fact that, you know, we're using inner products here sort of gives you a Hilbert space structure, so that sort of ties in with L2 norms as well. Okay. So this is just an intuition. This isn't quite precise. The real issue is what happens when you start to look at linear combinations of vectors that are separated by not very much, because even though these guys are pointing in the same direction, they still span two dimensions. Okay. And from some point of view, you don't really want them to do that. You really want to think about these as pointing in one direction, not two. So that's sort of the problem with like numerical rank deficiency, where you'll wind up with a matrix that's not really rank deficient, but for numerical purposes it is. Okay, so the way we quantify this is with the coherence statistic. And that's defined as the maximum inner product between distinct atoms. And it's denoted noted with a mu. And so in this case, you can see that the coherence is small. So the angles are big, so the cosines of the angles are small. Okay. In this case, we've got this pair of vectors here that's very close to each other. The angle is small, so the cosine is close to 1. And so you can also think about this as the cosine of the angle between phij and vk. All right. So a quick example here. Dictionary, where, as I mentioned, you've got these two different kinds of atoms here. You've got spikes, so zero everywhere except where it goes up to 1, and then you've got these sinusoids. And so here, it only comes up to 1 over the square root of d. So because a complex exponential has magnitude 1, and you've normalized by 1 over root d. So none of the entries of the complex exponential is ever bigger than 1 over root d. Okay. Now, if you look at the inner product between any pair of impulses, it's 0, because the spikes are in two different places. Okay. If you look at the inner product between two complex exponentials, it's also 0. But if you take the inner product between an impulse and a sinusoid, the spike here picks out one of the entries, and that one entry is magnitude 1 over the square root of d. So in this case, we've got mu equals 1 over the square root of d, the dimension of the dictionary. Is this calculation clear? And so what you see is that the coherence can be pretty small. And when you're working in a large dimensional space, the coherence can be really small. Okay. And this is a sort of surprising fact about high dimensional spaces is that there's a lot of room in them. So you can put a lot of vectors onto a sphere before they start getting close together. Now, just say a few more words about coherence, but for our purposes today, you should really think about coherence as being about 1 over the square root of d, the ambient dimension of the space. So, if you want to know how big the coherence is, there's a result due to Welch from 1974, where he proves for a d by n dictionary, not the word he would have used, the coherence has a lower bound, which is n minus d over d times n minus 1. And this is pretty close to 1 over the square root of d. So the coherence can never be much smaller than this.
The coherence of what?
What?
Coherence of what? What's the dictionary?
Any dictionary. For a d by n dictionary. So if you've got this matrix V of n vectors of d dimensions, unit norm, then the maximum inner product between a pair of vectors meets this lower bound.
So I can make any two vectors line up.
No, yeah, it could always be worse than this. This is as small as it could be.
Oh, that's a small. Jeez.
Yeah.
That's really good.
But
what?
That's all that. You like that?
N is not or equal to d. If they're equal, then mu can be 0, right?
That's right. In fact, that's what you'll see here is that if n equals d, the numerator is 0. That bounds sharp in a variety of cases, which is a really interesting subject that we're not going to talk about. The key word here is Grassmannian frame. Or equiangular type frame, but unfortunately, a different direction. Okay, and I just want to add that there are large dictionaries with small coherence. So by large, I mean, for example, n equals d squared, and coherence is 1 over the square root of d. And in fact, you can make this polynomial higher order even without simplifying much. But I'm afraid that's another subject for another day. All right, now we move on to sort of what I view as the main subject of my lectures here, now that I've given you a little background, and that's the orthogonal matching pursuit algorithm. We only now come to lecture two. Algorithms.
Right.
So the orthogonal matching pursuit algorithm is actually based on the same principle as that orthogonal case that I just erased. So in the orthogonal case, there's a strategy where we're picking out the atoms that have the largest inner product with the signal one by one until we've got as many as we want. Okay. And so this suggests that you could do the same thing for more general dictionaries. Instead of trying to compute a matrix inverse or solving the least squares problem, you could try to make the approximation step by step. So you'll build up an approximation. Build up an approximation to x one atom at a time by choosing the best atom at each step. Pick one atom that's best for approximating x, form a new approximation, we have some stuff left over, we're going to pick the best atom for approximating the stuff that's left over, form a new approximation, have some stuff still left over, and we'll repeat. And that's precisely the idea behind this algorithm. I'll talk for a moment about other types of greedy algorithms after I sort of set down what this one does. So we usually abbreviate this as OMP. This algorithm goes back to the statistics literature sometime in the 50s. No one seems to know who invented it. So I usually don't give a reference anymore. So the input is a dictionary, a vector x that we're trying to approximate, and for our purposes, just the number of iterations n. So we'll think about solving the sparsity constraint problem. We're only going to allow ourselves m atoms from the dictionary to use in our approximation. And the output is an m sparse coefficient vector C so that x is approximated by V times C. So this linear combination of columns with these weights. M sparse means that the vector is M non-zero entries. Okay, so this is pretty straightforward terminology. And the initialization. Well, I'll tell you in a minute. There's some rigorous guarantees that are not very impressive, and then there's a theorem that's also not very impressive. But I suppose it depends on your point of view. Okay, so the initialization, you set your iteration counter to 1, your residual, so the stuff you have left to approximate, equal to the original signal, because you haven't approximated anything yet. And you set the coefficients to 0. All right. So step 1 is called greedy selection. So all we really have to look at is the residual. And so what we're going to do is try to approximate as much of the residual as we can, doing something dumb. So we're going to pick the atom that's most correlated with the residual. So we'll find the atom phi k sub t, so that k sub t maximizes the inner product between the residual and all the atoms in the dictionary. So we find the atom most correlated with the residual. It could be attained to multiple, and if it's attained to multiple atoms, just pick the one with the smallest index. Okay. The second step. So the reason this step is called greedy is because it's not trying to make any global decisions. It's only using the information it has right now and it's doing the best that it can.
So if t equals 1 in step 1?
Yeah, t equals 1 in step 1. So step 2 is the update of the approximation. So what we'll do here is we'll find coefficients ck1, ck2, and so forth up to ckt. So these are the coefficients associated with the atoms that we've picked up to this step, so that we minimize the L2 error in approximating x is a linear combination of those atoms. So we're going to solve the least squares problems here. We've picked t atoms so far, and we want to find the best linear combination of those atoms to approximate x in L2 norm. That's right, but only the ones that you've already looked at. Okay. So these are only the atoms that you've already chosen. This is not a sum with all of the atoms. It's just the ones you've picked. Is this clear? Not clear. So we just want to solve the least squares problem. And the basic idea is that you just want to do as well as you can with what you've got. And then you form a new approximation. A sub t, which is equal to phi times coefficient vector. So it's 0 everywhere except in these places. And you form a new residual. RT, which is equal to x minus the stuff that you've managed to approximate so far. So you can see this is also equal to x minus a. So we have this new residual now, and we will go back and iterate. So we increase t and repeat steps 1 and 2 until t is bigger than m. So we do it m times. That means incremental in C++ or in C. Okay. So a few notes on this thing. So on the computational costs, in general, step one is actually the most expensive part. Doing all those inner products there takes order d times n time. So you want to multiply a matrix, a d by n matrix by a vector. And it turns out the least square step is a bit cheaper. It's order t times d in iteration t. If you do a sort of iterative, like Gram-Schmidt sort of thing. Okay. And so the total cost over all the iterations is order m times n times d plus n squared times d. So you can work that out if you don't believe me. Or you may find I've made a mistake. So all the more reason to work it out.
What's m?
Hmm?
What's m?
M is the number of iterations we perform.
Oh, stopping criteria.
Yeah, so stopping criteria. And incidentally, I do want to emphasize you can solve that least squares problem efficiently. You don't have to solve it from scratch every time because you're using the columns you've already chosen. You just orthogonalize the new column to the old one.
Is it the rank one update?
It's a rank one update to a QR. Exactly. And
so this just jump. In a lot of things in numerical, like linear algebra, they do some iterative thing like this, but that's because they just want to get to any basis that spans the thing they're interested in. I mean, this is a very different flavor. You're interested in actual atoms.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, I mean, this is a very complicated dependency structure because of this 3D procedure. So it seems very different than what,
I think in your world, what you would call this is actually rank revealing QR would be greedy column pivot. But it doesn't have any guarantees the way that, like, you know, say the lines and stuff does.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, actually, what it will do.
But you want to get actual columns that mean something. You know, you want.
That's right.
The
that's
best.
Right.
So
you're not concerned about finding the range. You're not concerned about finding the range of the matrix. Okay. So it's definitely aimed at something else. You're approximating one target vector. Okay.
So if all
we overlook
this cost of step one.
Yeah. Okay. So Anna wants me to talk about some computer science. So let's say the dictionary is special. It's like this Dirac Fourier thing. Then you can compute the inner products much faster. So there's this thing called fast Fourier transform that allows you to do all the inner products in d log d time with the Fourier basis. You don't have to do any work to get the inner products with the Dirac basis. So in special cases, you may be able to do this faster. And what Anna's mentioning is actually a general tool from theoretical computer science called a nearest neighbor data structure that allows you to find the maximum inner product between a vector and some collection of vectors in a very small amount of time. These things take a very long time to build, and they take a lot of storage space, though. so there are cons for your pros. I should just emphasize that you don't necessarily have to compute those inner products in the stupid digital way.
So if you use like epsilon approximate your neighbor structure,
yeah,
so those similar guarantees go through.
You can prove almost all the same theorems. Okay. All right. Now, at each step, the residual is orthogonal to all of the atoms you've chosen so far. Oh, thank you. Because you've solved the least squares problem. Okay, so you've removed all of the part of x in the direction of those guys, so there's nothing left. Okay? And so what that tells you is that in this first step, when you go to compute inner products, you're never going to pick one of the guys that you already picked, because those inner products are zero. Okay? So OMP always picks a new column. Unless it's run out of signal to approximate. Okay? So, in particular, after n steps, so after n iterations, it has chosen m columns. So you really do have an m sparse approximation of the vector after. Now, I don't want to talk a lot about this right now, but there are approximately 300,000 billion varieties of greedy algorithms that are based on the same template. Do a greedy selection, do an approximation update, repeat, stop when something happens. Probably anything you think of has been thought of by someone else before, and probably no one has proven any theorems that it actually works. That's not to say that most of these other approaches aren't valuable, because I think probably a lot of them are smarter than this. So statisticians don't actually use this approach. They do a slightly more sophisticated greedy selection rule, usually. And this is an algorithm called forward selection. It's pretty commonly used in the social sciences, in spite of the fact that there aren't very many guarantees available for it. But lots of greedy algorithms.
What did you call it? What selection?
Forward selection. Oh. Yeah, there's also something called backward elimination where you throw columns out. Anyway, there are a lot of these things. I mean, do a forward, backward, then sideways, and good lord. But seriously, there are hundreds of these things. Thresholding, for example, is a greedy strategy where you just keep the big ones and throw everything else away and stop. Or do that iteratively. This is various things. Donahoe's got a version called Stomp, stage-wise orthogonal maximum pursuit. Anyway, so here's what people knew about OMP for a long time. It proved that OMP converges. Here's what that means. So the theorem, which is due to Ron DeVore and Vladimir Temelyakov. So suppose that phi is a complete dictionary for RD for any x the residual RT after T steps of OMP satisfies the bound on the next board so you can see it. Bound on the norm of the residual, and that's a constant divided by the square root of the number of iterations. Okay. I don't remember what the constant is, but it's like 2 or something. It's pretty small, and it doesn't depend on the dictionary or anything else. Okay. So what this tells you is that after t steps, there's not a lot of the vector left, and after d steps, you've got everything, because it takes d vectors to span d dimensions.
Okay.
But there's a problem here. What if you could write x with two columns? Well, it says R2 is C over root 2. It says the error is 50%. Something like that. So that's bad news. So this is not really the theorem that you want.
Is it best possible?
Yeah, it is best possible. I've actually seen this traced back to a work of Mari.
Mari as well.
But at any rate. The point is that sometimes OMP can find sparse representations. So this is a little surprising to people when Anna and her co-authors first identified this phenomenon, because everyone thought these greedy algorithms were totally stupid, because you can break them, and you can break them spectacularly. But it turns out that there are actually a lot of cases of interest where they work, and I'm going to spend the rest of this lecture and the next lecture telling you about some of those cases.
Okay.
So, suppose X is a vector whose sparsest representation contains M atoms. And we can write x equals the sum over the atoms in some set omega of some coefficients bk times some atoms here, and where the size of the set is equal to m. Okay, so omega is the set of atoms that participate in the vector x in its sparsest representation, and we just sum those atoms up with appropriate coefficients to get x. And the point is that m here is small. So, without loss of generality, the set of atoms here listed in omega is linearly independent. Why is that? Well, what if they weren't? Then you could throw one away. Okay, and that contradicts the maximal sparsity. Okay, and that also means that if we can find omega, we can find the coefficients. And you can do that just by inverting, well, not inverting, but computing the pseudo inverse of a matrix and so forth. Okay? So you can always solve this problem. It's a simple linear system, and once you know omega, it's got a unique solution, because the vectors listed in omega are a linearly independent family. Okay. Any questions on that?
Yeah. Are we assuming that the sparsest representation is unique?
No. That's a really interesting question. In the circumstances we'll describe, it will turn out that it has to be unique eventually. But I'm just assuming that it's a sparsest representation. All right. So another question is, when can OMP identify So what we'll do here is define a couple matrices. So we'll define phi omega to be the set of atoms that are listed in omega. So basically, we're taking that big matrix and we're throwing in all the stuff that isn't listed in our special set. Okay? These are technically known as good atoms. And we'll define phi omega to be the matrix with all the other columns. And these are technically known as bad atoms. Okay? So we split our big matrix phi into two pieces, the good guys and the bad guys. And we define the greedy selection ratio at a vector R to be the maximum inner product between the vector R and the bad atoms divided by the maximum inner product between R and the good atoms. Okay. So this is maximum inner product with bad atoms. This is maximum inner product with good atoms.
That could be it. Not sure. If R is orthogonal to the good atom.
That's right, but that means you found all of them.
Okay.
Yeah. So, in particular, remember in that first step of the algorithm, you pick the atom with the biggest inner product. So, if the biggest inner product is with a bad atom, that tells you that the greedy selection ratio is at least 1. And if the maximum inner product between the residual and an atom occurs at a good atom, the ratio is less than or equal to 1. Okay. So this is sort of the key quantity for deciding whether you've got one of the right ones or not. Okay. So rho r less than 1 means you choose a good atom. Okay. Now, you can also rewrite the ratio in rather more functional analytic terms as the inner product between phi, oops, I got this upside down. The inner products between the bad atoms and the residual vector and the infinity norm to pull the biggest one out. So this is the list of inner products between bad atoms and the residual, take the biggest one. And in the basement, we got phi omega transpose times R infinity norm. So this is the biggest inner product between the good atoms and the vector R. Okay. Now, that's a background, and the result is the exact recovery theorem. So a sufficient condition for orthogonal matching pursuit to identify omega after m steps is that the maximum inner product between, what's that number? The maximum of this funny looking quantity here less than one, and I've written the pseudo inverse as a plus sign. Okay, so we will look at all of the bad atoms. We'll multiply them into the pseudo inverse of the matrix with the good atoms, and we'll compute the L1 norm, and we'll hope that it's less than one. So this is called the exact recovery condition. I mean, duh. Okay, so we still have time to prove this result, even though it's not useful in its current form. In the next lecture, we'll talk about how to estimate this thing using things that make sense. Yeah.
So it's completely independent of the initial vector.
Yeah,
so
funny, isn't it? Except that omega depends on the initial vector. Yeah. But this is some funny geometric thing about the dictionary, where like the collection of columns that are actually participating.
So
yeah.
If I start out with an orthonormal basis and now sort of randomly put add minus the vector you already got. That's gonna mess that omega one, correct? And that's when you're gonna get non-numericness.
If you take an orthonormal basis and do what to it?
Just take a bunch of them and join minus the vectors you already have.
Oh yeah, that's kinda ruin every vector. But you don't really expect to tell the vectors apart.
Yeah, unless they sum them, you know, they're almost
right. That's hard.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the proof. So, first of all, you need to note that the initial residual, which is equal to the original vector, belongs to the range of this matrix V omega. And the reason is because you can write X as a linear combination of these good columns. Okay? And that's what the range is. Okay. So, an iteration t plus 1, we assume, so this is sort of an inductive proof, that the things we've chosen so far are all good. So assume that we haven't made any mistakes up to now. And so that means that the tth approximation belongs to the range of this matrix. And the reason is that AT is a linear combination of the columns we've chosen so far. They were all good columns. Okay? So it's in the range of the good columns. And that means that R of T, which is equal to X minus A of T, also belongs to the range of the omega. Okay? So it tells you the residual can be written with the good columns. Okay? Now, we can express the orthogonal projector onto the range of this matrix phi omega in terms of the pseudo inverse using this hideous expression, pseudo inverse of the matrix transpose times the transpose of the matrix. Okay, so that's another way to write the orthogonal projector onto this range. You should check this in the comfort of your own hotel room. And because this vector here is in the range of that matrix, that tells you that if you apply this matrix to this vector, RT, you get this vector back. Okay, a projector is an identity on its own range. So this action doesn't do anything to this vector. Okay? Who cares? The reason we care is because this actually lets us estimate this greedy selection ratio. So when we write this down, we've got this ratio of these two inner products And when I look at this, I see something that looks like an operator norm to me. But it's not quite right. We need a phi omega up top before we can apply this operator norm down. So what we're going to do is we're going to use this identity down here to rewrite RT as so what we've done here is said, well, RT is the same as this projector applied to RT, so we can stick this up into the attic. And now we've got a vector here and the same vector in the denominator, and so we can kill them off. So this is basically an operator norm now, and so this is less than the operator norm, the infinity operator norm of the matrix that's left. Okay, so this is the maximum L1 norm of any row of this matrix. Okay, I don't like rows, so I'm going to get rid of the transposes and get maximum L1 norm of any column. Okay, now let's just rewrite this. This is the maximum over the columns of this guy, which are the bad atoms, times the L1 norm of this vector. And that's less than 1 by hypothesis. And so what this tells us is that because the selection ratio is less than 1, we pick a good atom. At iteration T. And that completes the induction. So after m steps, we pick all M of the good atoms. So every step we pick a new atom. We know that every time we pick an atom, it's a good one. And as a result, by our hypothesis, we wind up picking all M of the good atoms after M steps. And notice that after you've picked all M of those atoms, you've approximated the entire vector, and there's nothing left. So the residual is zero, and you know to stop. And now I know to stop so that you can have some more coffee.